Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the meetings today on Capitol Hill between Donald Trump and Republican leaders, including Speaker Paul Ryan, and speak with a longtime senior congressional staffer, Mike Lofgren, the author of The Party Is Over, How Republicans Went Crazy, Democrats Became Useless, and the Middle Class Got Shafted. We will discuss the possibility that, as former Speaker John Boehner suggested, Mr. Ryan was looking to, quote, help shape Trump's policies and examine the extent to which the struggle between Trump and the Republican establishment is not about unity, but is more about Trump being brought into line to abandon his populist promises to raise taxes on the rich and preserve Social Security. We will look into whether Trump could be handled to follow the game plan of hyping the deficit as a distraction to justify the sacrifices working and middle-class Americans are expected to make while the GOP cuts taxes on the top 1%. Then, now that the president of Brazil is facing impeachment, we'll try to get some clarity on what is behind this political upheaval in a country that in 3 months from now will be hosting the Olympic Games. Alexander Main, the Senior Associate for International Policy at the Center for Economic and Policy Research, joins us to discuss the extraordinary turn of events that have replaced an elected president halfway through her term on specious grounds involving vague charges with a much more unpopular replacement from another party who is mired in legal troubles and corruption charges. Then finally, we'll go to Italy to speak with the economist Randall Ray, professor of economics at Bard College and a senior scholar at the Levy Economics Institute, about the economic repercussions of a so-called Brexit if the UK were to leave the EU following the June 23rd referendum. We'll look into whether the EU could unravel and how a Brexit could affect the American economy and the upcoming elections. We will also discuss Randall Ray's latest book, Why Minsky Matters, An Introduction to a Maverick Economist. And joining us now is Mike Lofgren, who has spent 28 years working in Congress, the last 16 as a senior analyst on the House and Senate budget committees, which gave him ringside seats on TARP, Hurricane Katrina disaster relief, debates on the Pentagon budget, and the amazing antics of various deficit reduction commissions. He's the author of the New York Times bestseller, The Party Is Over, How Republicans Went Crazy, Democrats Became Useless, and the Middle Class Got Shafted. And his latest book is The Deep State, The Fall of the Constitution and the Rise of a Shadow Government. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mike Lofgren.
Well, it's good to be here again, Ian.
And Mike, what do you make of this unity summit on Capitol Hill today where Donald Trump met with Republican leaders, in particular Paul Ryan? All of the coverage is sort of kumbaya about party unity and how they're all going to get on famously. I thought the most interesting and revealing statement actually came from John Boehner, who said that in regard to this meeting between Trump and Ryan, said, things are going to get smoothed over, Boehner said, adding that Mr. Ryan was looking to help shape Mr. Trump's policies. And that's my feeling of what really is going on here, that this is more about Trump being told by the Republican establishment to abandon all of his populist promises about raising taxes on the rich and protecting Social Security, but to get behind the Ayn Rand or the Ayn Rand agenda.
Well, shaping Trump's policies is kind of like nailing a blob of mercury to the wall. It's just not possible. And the Trump people themselves, according to a CNN report, a Trump aide said there were no expectations at all of an immediate Ryan endorsement. And one of Ryan's pals in the House, Lynn Westmoreland of Georgia, was surprised that Ryan did not endorse Trump. So make of that what you will.
So what do you think this kabuki theater is about then?
I think it's mainly symbolism in the age of TV and Snapchat and Twitter, just to try to prove something. And as you said, send out the vibes of kumbaya. But I don't think necessarily the reporters were buying it, that were talking to people like Ryan after the event.
So if this is not really then about the mountain coming to the Muhammad or the reverse, I mean, you think that Trump's got enough leverage over them and his Tea Party backers that basically he can ignore the Republican establishment? We know why the Republican establishment is nervous, particularly the Ryans of the world, because all of his members are saying, you know, this guy's going to bring us down in the general. We're going to lose our seats, even in a gerrymandered House, and particularly in a Senate. They're very likely to lose the Republicans. So walk us through that then. Who's got the upper hand? The people who are panicked they're going to be subject to down-ticket damage and want to limit the damage, or this kind of insurgency of Tea Party radicals that are behind Trump? And as all of them acknowledged, Trump has earned the votes. He's gotten the delegates. You know, if you can't deny the fundamentals of the democratic process.
Well, ask yourself, who has always had the upper hand? It's been Trump. And even when it didn't involve Trump, these crazies had the upper hand. That's why John Boehner is no longer speaker. And I will note that a number of senators also met with Trump. And according to the news reports, the Senate Majority Leader, Mitch McConnell, told the reporters that the Trump meeting was constructive. Now, people old enough to remember when the U.S. was always negotiating with the Soviet Union, and our negotiators went off to Geneva, and they said the meeting was constructive, that was one level above frank, which means they were throwing things at each other. So I don't know that that portends any great kumbaya, because the House is so gerrymandered that they'll probably get through even in a wave election, but the Senate is very primed to flip. You've got a lot of vulnerable Republicans who were elected in 2010 in the midterms there, who are up, like Mark Kirk in Illinois and many others, and they are terrified of losing their seats. But how are they going to stop Trump? They threw everything they had at him in the primaries, and it didn't work. I think he's in the catbird seat.
So is this then, again, you think there's some vestiges of the Ryan Romney ticket here? Is Ryan having to go through this ritual to play the good cop, bad cop, even though he's basically said that the meeting went well with Trump? And he looks forward to them working on party unity. Is this any, I mean, I don't understand what the role of Ryan is here, unless he's trying to shape, as Boehner said, help shape Trump's policies. What other role is he playing here?
Well, I mean, he has all kinds of forces pushing every which way on him. As the Speaker of the House, you're basically the headmaster or headmistress of the world's greatest kindergarten. Plus, you know, he has all kinds of other ideological forces. He's got Trump on the one hand, and then he has the Daddy Warbucks crowd of, for instance, the Koch brothers, who are very influential, who are not all that thrilled with Donald Trump. So he kind of has to straddle a very fine line here.
But Trump's already made indications that he's backing away from raising taxes on the rich. So has somebody got to him?
Well, he's all over the map. You know, was he being serious then? Is he being serious now? He said he would raise taxes on the wealthy, but long ago he released some tax plan that the total fiscal impact, I think it was the Tax Policy Center, or the no, it was actually the Tax Foundation, said it would cost $12 trillion in extra deficits over 10 years. And yet he said he would start to pay down the deficit and balance the budget within 8 years. The math was totally crazy then. Do we believe him then, or do we believe him now?
And again, I'm speaking with Mark Lofgren, who has spent 28 years working in Congress, the last 16 as a senior analyst on the House and Senate budget committees, which gave him ringside seats on TARP, Hurricane Katrina, disaster relief, debates on the Pentagon budget, and the amazing antics of various deficit reduction commissions. He's the author of the New York Times bestseller, The Party Is Over, How Republicans Went Crazy, Democrats Became Useless, and the Middle Class Got Shafted. And his latest book is The Deep State, The Fall of the Constitution and the Rise of a Shadow Government. So if Trump, and you know, there's no question that his tax plan, I didn't know that, I'd heard figures of $9 trillion, but $9 trillion, $10 trillion, whatever the difference is minor given...
Well, the various foundations have right. come up with different estimates. That's not right. unusual.
Sure.
But, you know, it's somewhere up there in the high single right. digit or low double-digit trillions.
Sure, sure. It makes voodoo economics look like child's play. But he has come out against the carried interest, which is what all the hedge fund people live off, where they get only have to pay 15% tax. And he's already indicated that he's happy to go after the hedge fund people because he alleges they support Hillary. So what is there you can believe about this guy? I guess that's my question.
Well, not really that much because, okay, on the one hand, he's taking away their carried interest deduction, but on the other, he's vastly lowering their personal income tax rate for these billionaire hedge fund managers. So it may come out as a wash.
Well, then what are we to make of this so-called split in the Republican Party and this theatrics today on Capitol Hill about party unity? My understanding from talking to longtime students of Congress and historians is that this could be a watershed moment with the Republican Party from which it may not recover and the party could split.
Well, let's put it this way. The Republican Party has been pretty enthusiastically dumping toxic waste into the waters of public discourse for many years. And now, to their dismay, they've suddenly seen, slithering out of those murky depths, this mutant swamp creature they couldn't control, named Donald Trump. You know, they'd spent for, I think, 3 decades explaining to their base the virtues of laissez-faire economics, free trade, small government, at the same time they were baiting them with this culture war stuff about scapegoating ethnic minorities, gays, and anyone else that served the purpose. And suddenly they discovered none of that stuck with the base. Because they weren't going to sacrifice their Social Security or Medicare on the altar of entitlement reform. The only thing that stuck with them was this residue of cultural resentment, bigotry, and xenophobia. So they're stuck with the guy. They created him.
So does that mean to say, though, that the so-called traditional Republicans, not that they're not an endangered species and they're few and far between, is there not enough of them to form a kind of rump party and let the Tea Party go their own way?
The American system simply does not allow for more than two parties. They created him within the big tent, so-called, of the Republican Party, and they're stuck with him. And he may transition the party to a nativist and protectionist party that's against some of the precepts of their economic elites, but so be it. That's the way it is.
Well, I suppose, on the one hand, I'm of the impression that the Ryans of this world, since he's influenced by Ayn Rand, he gets a pretty free pass as being this serious, wonkish, brilliant guy that's really an expert on policies, when in fact he's just a raging nutcase ideologue in the way that Trump's a raging nutcase populist. I mean, I don't see a greater difference between the two. But the accident of history is that sometimes, like a broken clock is right twice a day, Trump says some useful and encouraging things about protecting Social Security, cutting taxes on the wealthy, investing in infrastructure, not getting into more foreign wars. And much of what he says is real heresy to the Republican orthodoxy, both in domestic politics and in foreign policy.
Yes, that's absolutely right, Ian. And I will emphasize again, it really doesn't resonate with the Republican base. All they really cared about was the culture war stuff and the sort of resentment against people who they thought were getting unearned benefits through affirmative action or whatever. The guy in Muncie, Indiana, or Fort Wayne, or Toledo, Ohio, on the assembly line, what did he get out of free trade? He pulled the lever maybe for the Republicans, and now he's kind of wising up.
Well, I did think that efforts on the part of the so-called Republican establishment to encourage Donald Trump to be more presidential were kind of blowing in the wind. And it's been proven to be the case, because lately on the stump, he just goes completely off script and goes. The other day he was ranting against Lindsey Graham, who's essentially a nobody who he thrashed in the elections, so why pick on him anymore? But apparently Lindsey Graham said something that got under Trump's skin. And there he was just going on and on and on forever. And I noticed the other day that Jon Stewart, the Daily Show host who's in retirement, was speaking at a university in Chicago and described Donald Trump as a man baby. And I think there is something to that. I think this guy is pretty much uncontrollable.
Well, he's not going to change, however much the GOP wants him to, because he can't. I mean, his character is set. It was set sometime in the mid-80s, if not before, because the New York media, the corporate media that is supposedly the gatekeepers of what is acceptable in America, went gaga over him. All the financial channels, FNN, which was the predecessor of CNBC, they were always going on about Donald Trump and his latest escapade. They built this guy up. 30 Rock at NBC, they gave him a reality TV show to be beamed into the remotest hollow in East Kentucky. So they essentially created this guy and sent him out to the audience that the Republican Party had already created with their culture wars.
So do you think that the same media that's given Donald Trump $2 billion worth of free publicity will turn on him?
I don't think they can, because all the memes that have been sort of absorbed by the Republican base are don't trust the media. So they can say anything they like about Trump University and the fraud that it's perpetrated on ordinary working people who thought they were going to get an education, the four bankruptcies he's had, his casinos, and how do casinos, which by definition make money, how did they go bust? They went bust. They can say these things, and it will just be like throwing pebbles at armor plate. It will just bounce off their consciousness.
So what about the possibility then of, you know, I don't know what the constituency for Trump is, and that's something we're going to find out. But I just know that so many people that I know thought that Ronald Reagan was a joke and would never make it, and that George W. Bush was a joke and would never make it. And I'm not sure you can rest on any kind of comfort that Trump may not make it. He certainly is a joke, and an embarrassing one at that. But that's not to say that he's not going to make it. But the one thing that could tip the scale, surely, is an ISIS-type terrorist attack here in the United States, or even the exit from the EU, the Brexit, as it's called, which is being voted on in Britain on June the 23rd. That's going to create an economic turmoil.
Well, definitely. And Trump's presumptive opponent, Hillary, has a lot of high negatives. So there's that to deal with. And if there is such an event, Lord help us, because I would say, in addition to the Republican Party, our national security state also helped create Trump, because they've been dinning into people's heads for 15 years now to be very, very afraid of terrorism. And notwithstanding that you stand a much greater chance of slipping and falling and dying in your bathtub than at the hands of a terrorist, nevertheless, this stuff has activated the latent paranoia and authoritarianism in a lot of people. And Trump, with his claiming that he's going to bomb the expletive out of ISIS and claiming he'll go to the limit on torture, not just for information, which we all know you can't really elicit from torture anyway, mainly for the revenge. And there's a lot of people harboring revenge fantasies now because of this constant fear of terrorism. So Donald Trump, even though he's completely ignorant about national security, he doesn't know what the nuclear triad is, he's a natural for this kind of thing because of his inborn aggression, snarkiness, and authoritarianism.
So do you think that this country could, I mean, he's certainly, there's no mystery why he identifies with Putin, his authoritarian instincts and the fact that he sees foreign policy as just deal-making, and you make deals with the mafia to get your buildings made, so what's the problem?
That's exactly right. He sees that as a sort of transactional thing, and given how our national security elites have failed, people might just take a flyer and take a chance on Donald Trump.
Well, Mark Lofgren, on that note, I thank you very much for joining us, and I appreciate it.
Enjoyed it, Ian.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Mark Lofgren, who spent 28 years working in Congress, the last 16 as a senior analyst on the House and Senate budget committees, which gave him ringside seats on TARP, Hurricane Katrina disaster relief, debates on the Pentagon budget, and the amazing antics of various deficit reduction commissions. He's the author of the New York Times bestseller, The Party Is Over, How Republicans Went Crazy, Democrats Became Useless, and the Middle Class Got Shafted. And his latest book is The Deep State, The Fall of the Constitution and the Rise of a Shadow Government. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back with more of Background Briefing.
Who do you think you are? Bless your
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Alexander Main, a Senior Associate for International Policy at the Center for Economic and Policy Research, with a focus on U.S. foreign policy towards Latin America. His areas of expertise include Latin American integration and regionalism, U.S. security and counter-narcotics policy, and U.S. relations with Bolivia, Ecuador, Honduras, Venezuela, and Brazil. Welcome to Background Briefing, Alexander Main.
Great to be on your show, Ian.
And Alexander, this is an extraordinary turn of events, and not that it was that surprising in Brazil with the impeachment of Dilma Rousseff, the president. She's been stripped of her presidential duties for up to 6 months after the Senate voted 55-22 to suspend the Workers' Party leader. And the amazing thing is that the vice president, who's to essentially take over, is even less popular, doesn't even belong to the same party, and has more real, tangible legal problems hanging over his head. So it's a bit strange, isn't it, what's happening there in Brazil?
Well, yeah, it's very strange. And I think it's hard to understand if one doesn't understand Brazil's very fractured political environment, which has really always been the case and has certainly been true during the PT years, which started, of course, with the election of Lula da Silva in 2002, and he came to power in 2003. And they had been in power for 13 years until today, essentially, when Dilma was, of course, removed. But she always relied on a very tenuous, fragile coalition in which she counted on the support of some center-right parties and parties that are even hard to define ideologically, really, which is the case of the PMDB, which is the party with the largest amount of seats in the Brazilian Congress at the moment, but which includes people who consider themselves from the left and all the way to the extreme right. And there's very little sort of semblance of unity between them, although they are unified at the moment in opposing Dilma Rousseff. And so the vice president, therefore, is from that party, the PMDB, And really, her days began to be counted starting from the moment that the PMDB in its majority stopped supporting Dilma Rousseff, which really began to take place a few months ago. And what we've seen, I think, is sort of fairly described as a slow-motion coup, and not a classic coup, you know, not a military coup like the one we saw in Honduras a few years back, where the military got the elected president out of bed at gunpoint and put him on a plane to Costa Rica. In this case, it's something closer to what we saw in Paraguay in June of 2012, in which formally the rules are being followed, in this case the impeachment rules, but they're really violating the principles of the Constitution and of democracy in Brazil. In this case, impeachment is only to be used really in the case of high crimes, of very obvious criminality, and that's simply not the case with Dilma Rousseff. They've looked as hard as they can for any sort of wrongdoing, and the only thing that they came up with was the manipulation of some budget numbers, something that's sort of routinely done by presidents and was done previous to Dilma Rousseff, sort of automatically to sort of make the budget numbers look a little bit more positive than they are, let's say, certainly not a major crime. And again, if it is any kind of crime, it's one that's been repeated many times in Brazil's history by a variety of elected officials, and they have never been charged with anything. So this is what they found to pin on her. And, you know, I mean, I think it's worth noting that if this can be pinned on her, it can certainly be pinned on the vice president as well, who signed off on the same budget numbers. But that hasn't been brought up, although there is some talk of perhaps an attempt to impeach him on the same grounds later on. But it is eminently political, what's going on. It's not driven by concerns for any sort of criminal action on the part of Dilma, but rather this is a real power grab on the part of, I would say the right-wing elites of Brazil that have been frustrated in election after election since 2002, where they haven't been able to gain the presidency. And they got sort of closer than they had since the first election of Lula in 2002 in the elections of December 2014, in which Dilma was reelected with a smaller margin than in previous elections of 4 points. Originally, the opposition claimed that there had been fraud, they wanted a recount, new elections, and so on, based on absolutely no evidence. And then they quickly turned to this whole plan of impeachment to get her out of office and take over and implement the agenda that they've been wanting to implement for many years now.
And again, I'm speaking with Alexander Main, who's a senior associate for international policy at the Center for Economic and Policy Research, with a focus on U.S. foreign policy towards Latin America. His areas of expertise include Latin American integration and regionalism, U.S. security and counter-narcotics policy, and U.S. relations with Bolivia, Ecuador, Honduras, Venezuela, and Brazil. But why not have an election? I mean, I know it's not a parliamentary system in the U.K. model, is anybody calling for a new election? Isn't that the way that you should decide the situation in a democracy? Because the idea that she's being booted out or impeached halfway through her term based upon pretty specious charges, but the guy that's replacing her is not only from a different party, but he has real corruption charges over his head. He's been involved in illegal ethanol purchasing schemes, and he's just been found guilty and fined for election spending violations and faces an 8-year ban on running for any office. So do the people who are getting rid of Dilma Rousseff have somebody else in mind? Because this vice president, Michel Temer, he's incredibly unpopular. She's lost popularity, clearly, but he's even, got 2% popularity or something.
Well, absolutely not. They don't have anyone else in mind, and I think they do want to try to keep him there until the end of what should be Dilma's mandate, which comes to an end in December of 2018. So they've got, quite a while still, and you have had calls for elections from some groups, including from people from within the PT, Workers' Party of Dilma Rousseff and Lula da Silva. This has been ignored. I think this may well be the tack that the PT and its majority will take going forward, calling for elections, because this is so clearly undemocratic, and particularly given that the vice president is already naming cabinet ministers and making sort of pledges in terms of his policy agenda and his economic agenda in particular, that, of course, voters in Brazil never asked for. They certainly didn't vote for that when they voted for Dilma back in December of 2014, quite the contrary. So this new government that is emerging has really no popular legitimacy, and I think the calls for new elections will probably gain a lot of weight very quickly. There are already polls that show that the majority of Brazilians would prefer that to what is happening now. They would prefer new elections. But again, the opposition doesn't have anyone to propose. And at the moment, should Michel Temer also go down, if he should be impeached himself, which I think is unlikely but could always happen, then the next person in line is the president of the Chamber of Deputies, who also has corruption charges hanging over his head. And in fact, you know, all of the people that have been driving this whole impeachment against Dilma are among the most corrupt politicians in Brazil, including including Eduardo Cunha, who was the previous president of the Chamber of Deputies and was removed just a few days after the impeachment vote against Dilma, which he led. And he was removed because they found $40 million in secret Swiss bank accounts under his name, which are quite clearly the result of corruption and bribery. So these are the sorts of people that have been behind the drive to get Dilma Rousseff out. And again, she, there's no evidence whatsoever of her involvement in any sorts of corrupt activities, despite, of course, an enormous amount of corruption that has really involved all of the major parties in Brazil, including the PT, including Dilma Rousseff's own party.
So is this like the Bill Clinton impeachment that was purely political? They were sort of looking for anything to get him, and eventually, of course, he handed them the gift with Monica Lewinsky, but they were basically never argued on political terms, the Republicans. It was all about, you know, just ridiculous idea of somehow his private sexual activities were some great matter of state that required the impeachment. This feels a bit like that, the idea that this is a political vendetta. And in the case of the impeachment of Clinton, of course, you know, the Republicans never want to talk about issues. They always want to talk about abortion and everything else that's unrelated to the governance issues. And is this what's going on there in Brazil, where these people are playing these political games? But meanwhile, you've got the Olympics coming up in 3 months. You've got venues like for aquatic sports, where if you fall into the water, you're likely to die from pollution. You've got Zika spreading, this new horrible virus. It seems to me that this is a massive distraction.
Well, yeah, absolutely. I mean, it is a distraction. I mean, the thing is, it's gone a bit further than the Clinton impeachment, given that they have actually removed Dilma Rousseff from office, and it looks very likely that within 6 months she'll be permanently removed from office. And, you know, I think they've made a very big mistake because it's very clear that what they're doing is not grounded in any sort of legitimacy. There's no real crime involved. I mean, in the case of Bill Clinton, I mean, you could at least argue that you know, he was guilty of the crime of perjury, of lying under oath about his involvement with Monica Lewinsky. You know, there was some kind of a criminal case there. In the case of Dilma, there really isn't. And, you know, it was really striking on how on the day of the first vote for impeachment in the Chamber of Deputies, they didn't even bring up the charges against her because they're so laughable. I mean, they talk about anything but that. And so, yes, I mean, it is a massive distraction, but I think more than anything, again, it has to do with a frustrated power elite in Brazil that really controlled the political situation since the military dictatorship of the mid-1980s. Lost control with Lula, always assumed that they'd be able to win their way back thanks in part to their control of the major media of Brazil, which has been overwhelmingly anti-Dilma Rousseff and anti-PT, and has really led the campaign of the impeachment against her as well. And having failed to succeed through, you know, conventional electoral means, they've turned to this impeachment mechanism. And now they're inheriting a very, very complicated country in which I think you're going to see a good deal of instability, where lots of people, quite understandably, are going to be taking to the streets. They already are taking to the streets. Campesino groups, women's groups, Afro-Brazilian groups, and just, you know, vast mobilizations that are probably going to become more and more frequent as the new government attempts to implement a very right-wing agenda that, again, the people of Brazil did not vote for.
Well, Alexander Mayne, I thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Alexander Mayne, who's a senior associate for international policy at the Center for Economic and Policy Research, with a focus on U.S. foreign policy towards Latin America. His areas of expertise include Latin American integration and regionalism, U.S. security and counter-narcotics policy, and U.S. relations with Bolivia, Ecuador, Honduras, Venezuela, and Brazil. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back with more of Background Briefing.
A mark, a yen, a buck, or a pound is all that makes the world go round. That clinking, clanking sound can make the world go round. Money.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now from Europe is L. Randall Ray, who is a professor of economics at Bard College and a senior scholar at the Levy Economics Institute. He's the author of the new book, Why Minsky Matters, An Introduction to the Work of a Maverick Economist. Welcome to Background Briefing, Randall Ray.
Hi, good to be back.
And you're in Italy at the moment. And one of the extraordinary things that seems to be happening in terms, we've spoken over the years about the problems with the economies of the EU and the sort of north-south split and the austerity and the Germans versus the Greeks and the Spaniards, etc. But finally, it looks as though the European economy, after 8 years of floundering, is making a sort of fitful comeback. But the amazing thing is that a completely self-inflicted wound is looming on the horizon, and that is whether or not on June the 23rd, the British people will vote to exit the EU in the so-called Brexit. And that's expected to trigger a lot of turmoil in the financial markets, a lot of uncertainty, and probably reverse all of the gains. So it's bad enough living in a world beset by problems. But the idea that Prime Minister Cameron has created this problem, which could end up being a disaster for Europe and even the United States.
Yeah, I can't really comment on the politics in England because I'm just not sufficiently familiar with it. But the idea that the European Union is dragging down not only Europe, the UK, but also the global economies, I think has some justification, and you can sort of understand why people would want to get out of that.
Well, what are the people talking about there? I'm sure your fellow economists in the rest of Europe must be alarmed.
Well, yeah, the setup of the European Union in general, but more specifically of the European Monetary Union, really biases this whole region toward austerity and stagnation. There are, you know, a few lucky exceptions to that, but most countries are not that lucky.
Well, but my understanding is that if the Brits pull out of the EU, it's likely to have a contagion effect that could take other states out. And you already have, in fact, this Brexit thing is being driven by the UKIP, the British right wing. And supposedly this would play into the hands of Le Pen in France and other right wing parties that are growing. And, you know, there are elections in 2017 in France and Germany. So are people talking about the possible contagion effect of a Brexit?
Yeah, I'm sure they are. It makes it easier for the next one to leave if one leaves. And what it is that the whole idea was that you're going to have a unification and bring countries closer together. But because of the way that the whole thing was constructed, you've actually increased disunity and hostility, and not just between member nations, but within member nations, where you have this sort of right-wing rising up in many countries, including where I am now in Italy.
Well, how much has this influx of refugees had to do it? My understanding is it's exacerbated these tensions and given aid and comfort to the right-wing xenophobes. For example, the Chancellor of Austria just stepped down because his own Socialist Party wasn't sufficiently supporting him in a more humane approach, and they're apparently cowed by the rise of the right. So, and then they were, of course, right next door where you are in Italy, in the Brenner Pass between Italy and Austria, there was some substantial riots recently over right-wing groups trying to close off any conduit for refugees into Europe.
Yeah. Of course, the refugee crisis problem is not mostly Europe's fault at all. But because virtually every country has had to adopt austerity in order to meet the Maastricht criteria, they are feeling a burden even before there are any refugees. And so it makes it much harder to care for refugees when you're suffering yourselves.
So what's your sense then of where the sort of austerity programs of Europe stand? Are they sort of in abeyance?
I don't think so. I think that the whole system was created on a false premise, which is that you can run very tight fiscal budgets across the region. Every member nation can do this and still grow. But that is just plainly false. The only countries that can grow with fiscal restraint are the handful of countries that run current account surpluses. In other words, who run trade surpluses, with Germany being by far the biggest winner of that. Many countries that used to actually run some trade surpluses now find themselves running trade deficits, very large ones, including Italy and France, against Germany. And once you've done that, once you have gone into current account deficit territory, if you can't expand your fiscal deficit, then you will suffer stagnation, and not even worse than stagnation. Your private sector will start to run deficits and bury you in private sector debt, which is what set off the global financial crisis in the U.S. and spread quickly to Europe, because there are many countries in exactly the same situation as the United States.
Well, it seems, though, that what's happened, and it's certainly here in the United States, since, as you pointed out just then, that the U.S. sort of began this unraveling with the 2008 crash on Wall Street that took the global economy to the brink of collapse. But it's, of course, and that was the biggest transfer of private debt into public debt in history. and it has led to a situation where Wall Street is made whole and Main Street is languishing. And I think it's also affecting the politics of the country at the moment with the rise of populism on the left with Bernie Sanders and on the right with Donald Trump. But at its heart, it seems to be this massive con has been played on the people, and that is that we've inverted freedom for sacrifice. In other words, we all have to tighten our belts because we're in this collective problem that is not one of our own making, and yet we're saddled with it. And the people who created the problem have been rewarded and more powerful and more arrogant than ever.
Yeah, we're tightening our belts toward on our way to poverty. You know, what makes sense for individuals to do makes no sense for nations to do. So it does make sense in your own individual household to tighten your belt when times are bad and your income is down. But it sort of perversely works in the opposite direction for nations that as a whole. What you need to do is spend more and work your way out of a depression rather than spend less. And so we hear this analogy all the time that the government is just like our household, and that's actually exactly wrong. The government must behave in the opposite direction.
So how come we've sort of swallowed this orthodoxy? I mean, today, Donald Trump met with the Republican leaders on Capitol Hill, including the Speaker, Paul Ryan. And while most of the press coverage is that it was a kumbaya moment, my sense is that what's probably going on in those meetings is that Ryan is saying to Trump, forget about all of your populist promises of raising taxes on the rich and saving Social Security. You've got to get aboard my Ayn Rand program. I mean, to my mind, the ideologues who keep going on about deficits, which is really a smokescreen for cutting taxes on the rich, they haven't changed their tune one bit. And if anything, they're even more insistent than ever on this idea of tightening our belts while loosening the belts of the 1%.
Yeah, I suspect that what you said is correct, and that in the meeting they are sort of reading in the Riot Act that the Republican position, which also is the Democratic position, is that you can't talk about printing money to pay for your spending, that we all need to get on board, that the deficit is a problem, the government's going to go bankrupt, and we have to adopt austerity. We can't afford any of the goodies in your program or in Hillary Clinton's program or in Bernie Sanders' program because we've run out of money, which of course is nonsense. Trump was absolutely right. The government cannot run out of its own money, can't be forced to miss any payments, can never be forced into default. Trump was right.
And of course, Trump has been right on infrastructure too. He keeps talking about we need to invest in infrastructure. And I don't understand why we haven't invested in infrastructure given how low interest rates are.
Yeah. When I was a kid, we had U.S. savings bonds and you brought 25 cents a week to school and you put them in these little slots and eventually you got a savings bond that cost you $18.75 and became $25. So, yeah. We should do this. Now, I wouldn't link infrastructure spending to low interest rates. What I would link it to is high unemployment, unused capacity. That is the time that you want to bring resources to work to build your public infrastructure. And we've got plenty of unused resources. So that is what we should be doing now.
So why do you think Obama missed the boat and the Democrats? Because after all, they controlled after the 2008 election, they controlled the White House, the Senate, and the House. And yet they could only get through, and all the economists at the time said that it was a completely insufficient stimulus package.
You know, I don't have a good answer to that. I think that the Democrats had built up this whole mythology And it was largely, I guess, the new Democrats, the Southern Democrats, who had a new strategy for winning elections, which relied on fiscal austerity, becoming more Republican than the Republicans, that they either bought into the myth, or they think the myth is working for them, and so they're going to stick through it no matter what happens. That's the only explanation I have. Otherwise, I don't get it. Now, it's true, we had a bit of a scare back in the days of President Clinton, when we had high inflation that was very unpopular, and some people like Ronald Reagan linked that to deficit spending. Now, in reality, Carter's deficits were very small. And when Reagan came in, he ran much bigger deficits, and inflation came down. The inflation had really nothing to do with the budget deficits. It had everything to do with OPEC quadrupling the price of oil, plus a few other things that increased commodities prices and real estate prices, which eventually fed through to rents and so on. But I think that sort of got this belief going. And then we had a very long period of Reagan-Bush. And then the new Democrats concocted a strategy that eventually resulted in a Clinton presidency. And they just will not abandon that strategy.
But don't you think that, Randall Ray, that Bernie Sanders' campaign is pushed Hillary Clinton away from Wall Street and from, I can't imagine that she could possibly bring back Robert Rubin and Larry Summers and company.
I wouldn't bet against that. I think it is possible. I sort of expect to see Larry Summers back, Paul Krugman, who has pretty much adopted the party line since this campaign started, I think abandoning most of his principles. I expect to see him there too. So yes, Bernie has pushed her, I think, with her kicking and screaming. She doesn't want to do it, but she has had to do it. The new Democratic agenda is not popular among the voting population. And Bernie has come close, and I think in a free and fair election, he might well have won the whole thing.
I thank you very much for joining us here today, L. Randall Ray.
Thanks a lot.
And again, I've been speaking with L. Randall Ray, who's a professor of economics at Bard College and a senior scholar at the Levy Economic Institute. He's the author of the new book, Why Minsky Matters, An Introduction to the Work of a Maverick Economist. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.